You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 571, with a special guest, John Pearson, a.k.a. John Jughead, and we will talk with him right now. So anyways, first of all, we're here with M-More. M-More, what's happening?
Hey, not too much, just trying to keep warm.
M-More's reporting from Canada in her basement. We've got Hallie Bullitt out in Western New Jersey, I guess.
Am I in Western New Jersey?
I don't know. Where are you? You tell me.
John, this is the I don't know. I'm in New Jersey. I don't really know where I am in New Jersey. Because also there's all these like heated debates about what's Central Jersey and what's North. I think I'm in North. It's just North Jersey, right? Is it Western Jersey?
Was it Western? See, I agree that New Jersey has three segments. Southern Jersey, Central Jersey, North Jersey. Mm-hmm. I say that Southern Jersey begins at Camden and runs south. Central Jersey is Camden through like Trenton, and north of Trenton is like North Jersey. That's what I say.
People have very strong opinions about this. So Chris was doing a show once where he started talking about this on stage, and the audience, like members of the audience, were just screaming from their chairs, and screaming at one another, like, I know, you're like, they were arguing about whether there are highways that divide or whether it's biked. I don't know. I try not to get involved in this stuff.
Yeah, I don't know either. I was always surprised that Atlantic City and Hoboken were in the same state or even the same country.
Right.
and that is John Pearson. John, you know, there's this whole thing about like Die Hard a Christmas movie? You know, where's North Jersey? Where's Central? And honestly, I kind of just roll my eyes, say, this is not that interesting of a debate, the Die Hard and Christmas movie. Like, no, it's a manufactured debate that really. Do you agree with me that people argue about stuff for the sake of arguing when it's exhausting and tiring, or do you enjoy the frivolity of it and there's nothing wrong with whimsy?
Well, I'm more affected by what's called like the zeitgeist, and everyone seems to be talking about that Die Hard. It was in a movie. I heard some other radio show talk about it. So I just kind of avoid those topics that seem to be becoming, well, popular, quote unquote, in the mainstream. I don't mind talking about superfluous, mundane things. I enjoy that.
Well, you came to the right place. Anyway, listen. So the way that I've hooked up with John is I wrote with Brad Logan, Architects of Self Destruction, Oral History of Leftover Crack, and I said, John, will you have Brad on your podcast? And John was like, yes. And then John gave an incredible interview with Brad. It was sensitive, it was interesting, but it also wasn't a lightweight interview. And John is one of the best, I guess, artist-to-artist interviewers out there right now. He's got an incredible podcast called Jughead's Basement. They're about to hit episode 100. You can find it just by Googling Jughead's Basement. But I think you got a Patreon too, right, John?
I do have a Patreon, yes, and I'm pushing that hard.
So how do people find the Patreon? They just do Jughead's Basement Patreon? Or?
Yeah, they go to actually Jughead's Basement – oh, wait, jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. There's a big link for the Patreon, so that would be good.
So everyone should at least check out a couple episodes. His interview with Polly Van Damme of the Bomb Pops was really good. His interview with Brad Logan of Leftover Crack was especially good. And so check out his podcast. It's real, real cool. John, first question is, you know, Joey Shithead Keithley. You can tell when people call him Joey Shithead, he kind of like clenches his teeth and he's like 60-something. He's a politician. He's like, you can tell in his mind, he never says that loud, in his mind, he's like, I came up with the name Joey Shithead when I'm 16. I don't want people calling me Shithead when I'm 62. Similarly, Fat Mike. People say, hey, Fat Mike. And you can tell it doesn't bother Fat Mike as much, but he never calls himself Fat Mike. He always calls himself Mike. And it's like, do you always want to be associated with this negative attribute, Joey Shithead? Fat head, you know, Fat Mike. John, yeah. Jughead, do you enjoy the name? Are you like, damn straight, I'm John Jughead? Or are you, you know, John Pearson at this point?
Well, I'm not fat or shit, so I'm above already there. No, it's never bothered me. I'm not even an Archie's fan, so it came more from the fact that I used to juggle a lot at shows, so it doesn't bother me. I even put it back into my name because there's a John Pearson that produces films. He did like Clerks and stuff like that. So, I used to get his mail, like people would send scripts to me. So I actually put the Jughead back in cause I'm proud of it. And it helps differentiate me from other John Pearsons. So
I love the juggling trivia. I didn't know that. That's
amazing. Oh yeah.
Were you juggling before bands or after bands? Like, how did the juggling and bands intersect, you know?
Well, juggling started when I was little and I taught myself. And it wasn't for performance. It was for – it would calm me down. It was like a zen thing for me. So I think I started doing it at shows just to calm down because I would get too excited. And then, you know, then sometimes people would watch. But I tried to do it and like hide somewhere and do it. But I just
love that. I'm going to really ground myself with juggling. I'm going to find my zen. Let me go find something to juggle.
Yeah, I know it sounds bizarre, but it's very true. It really calms me down. There's something about the rhythm and the pattern that's very calming about it. Yeah.
No, I would imagine it's probably like a little meditative, right?
Yeah. It is definitely. Yeah.
Anything where you have to, you know, they say that's why yoga is so good for the mind, because they say any activity where you're engaged so wholly with the activity that it quiets all those other extra.
Yeah, it has everything. It has a rhythm. There's, you know, like music is very important to the rhythm of, you know, as a baby and its mother's heart. There's something about the rhythm of it. Yeah. And there's balance involved too when you're juggling, so it has it all.
Do you still juggle?
I do. I do quite a bit, but like I said, I don't really like doing it as a job or a performance or in a carnival or anything like that. I just do it for myself.
Do you not like talking about it, or are you? Are
no,
you,
I talk about it. I like it. I'm actually really good. I'm a very good juggler, but it's not a performance thing.
So you could argue that you're the truest of all artists because you do juggling art not for anybody else but for yourself.
Yes, but I would argue as an artist that there is no artist without an audience. So I would just call it a more therapeutic exercise, I would think.
But like, what's the most number of items you've had in the air at once?
I can do five. I don't concentrate on five. I do like four in circles and all different patterns with it, but I can do five. And I've done like bowling balls and marbles and socks and things like that at the same time. So.
So John, is the podcast kind of like the main brunt of your artistic strikes right now, or is it mitochondriacs, or maybe you are divided equally in all these aspects? Like, what's your main art focus these days?
Well, that's something I learned a long time ago about myself, is I'm actually better if I spread it out amongst a few different things, because then they influence each other. Like then, you know, it's nice for me not to just focus on a book or not focus just on the podcast or just focus on the band. But to be honest, most of my energy lately has been focused on the podcast, because I'm trying to build it. I'm trying to get better at it. I'm trying to make it a job, and that's really difficult in the podcast world. But I'm giving it my best try to do that.
John's like a super interesting guy, in case the listeners don't know. Of course, he was in Screeching Weasel. He's in Mitochondriacs. He's even in the Blackouts. But also, he's a juggler, as we've learned. He's written plays for the Neo-Futurists. And also, I think he worked for like Universal Japan or something back in the day or something.
Well, just last year, yeah.
Oh,
6 years in Japan as Ollivander in the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. So I still do that. I still go back occasionally. Because they taught me Japanese, so it's kind of – they like to bring people back because it's hard to reteach people.
John's blowing my mind. So you do Japanese language Harry Potter, and you play a character in the Harry Potter play in Japan. Is that what you're saying?
Hi, so this.
So I mean, what's your take on Harry Potter? Do you, like, love Harry Potter, or is it just a job?
I do not. I was big into the movies because every Harry Potter movie they would – they're one of the movies that would introduce like new effects and new ways of doing things. So I would make sure to watch them all, but I was never a huge fan. I read the first book and I thought it was juvenile. I mean, juvenile, not in a good way. Like, I just thought it was really too simple, but she caught something that everyone loves. I mean, I'm not going to take that away from her, and she wouldn't let me. She's a billionaire. So. But no, I've read the first three books, and then I realized I didn't need to know that information for my job, because they don't want you existing in that world. They just want you to exist in the wand room. So I didn't need to know anything other than what I did in that room. So I stopped studying it.
So what's it like when you're up there, you're doing your 87th performance, your 92nd performance? Are you feeling it, or are you just like sleepwalking through something, you know?
Well, that's a good question, because I'm not a theme park person, because that's what they get really good at is – doing the same show. Like, I have to do it. I had to do it like 100 times a week. But the cool thing about, I'll give it to this, about this one show in all of the theme parks, is that there's a randomness amount, because I choose an audience member, so I get to do that myself. And there's 13 different wands that we have to learn, and qualities for those wands. So you get to actually analyze the person you choose and decide what wand they get. Hmm. So it's basically has like thousands of different combinations of the show that you can do. So it's really unique for an actor in theme park world to enjoy this. Makes it a little bit easier.
Hallie, you did acting. When you were doing acting and when you were up there, you know, number 47, number 57, number 87, number 137, what's it like up there when you're, you know, 137th run through, you know, 3 months in?
I mean, I just got lucky in that the shows that I did, like the only like conventional theater show that I did, as you know, was Rent. And I played like 5 different roles in Rent. So there weren't that many nights that I was going on and doing the same thing. I guess there was probably a 9-month stretch there where I was going on as the same role. That does feel maddening. Eight shows a week. And people will complain about their job. They'll be like, oh, every time I go to work, it's the same old thing. And you're a little bit like, oh, you don't even know. Like at my job, I have to pull my chair out at the exact same angle every night. And then I have to like sit down on the same like count of like 1, 2, 3, 4, mm-hmm. 5, like, you know, but I don't know. You're doing something you love. And then I got lucky in that most of the other shows that I did, we like at Stomp, at all the other shows I did, because they were so physically demanding, we would rotate the roles every single night, because otherwise you'd get too many sort of like repetitive use injuries. And so you'd be switching around what acts you were in and what parts of your body you were abusing the most any given night. So that helps keep it fresh. I do remember at some point I did take like an improv class, even though I wasn't interested in improv, because I just wanted to get like back into the habit of like really having to listen and react off of a person. I wanted to like reconnect to that mm-hmm. part of performing, just because I was in a show that I'd been doing for like a year and a half already. And I loved it and I wanted to continue to do it, but I wanted to make sure that my performance was still like, yeah, I don't know, like genuine. But like, yeah, you know, John, it sounds so cool what you're saying, because what you're describing is like, you really are, you're improvising in character.
Yeah, with script.
Every single
script,
time,
you're
right?
You're able to, play around with it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really
But
cool.
I also have, over the years, I mean, I've done straight plays, and I did a Broadway tour of Once for about a year. That was interesting, in front of like 1,000 people every night. And what you get really good at that type of acting is you start paying more attention to the little moments. Like, that's why ensembles are important. You start paying attention to all the things that are different with the audience, the different sounds you hear, to sort of thrive on that spontaneity of the moment. And then and being as precise as you can is also an art that's very exciting. But I came from an improv background. Like, I taught at Second City and did that for about 15 years. So I do have that in me that likes it to be a little bit different every night.
John, with regards to your podcast, a thing that I'm always, I don't want to say fighting, but pushing against and kind of pushing the writers is, punk news hypothetically is news, not a fanzine. You know what I mean? And I realize it's kind of still say, oh, punk news, you know, news. But I do like to treat it as much like news as we can. And so it seems more and more publications are becoming not news publications, but fanzines, you know, like, oh, we love this, we love that, you should go out and buy this record. Whereas punk news, I like to address things as objectively as we can and review records with the same, not necessarily the same hoity-toityness, but the same approach or the same level of intensity that like Pitchfork does, or like, you know, Atlantic Book Review. And so my question is, with your podcast, do you worry about walking the line between saying everyone should, you know, love Brad Logan and check him out? Or is there a certain, you know, no, let's do the Larry King style type where we, you know, slice into you a little bit and kind of pat ourselves on the back for doing that? You know what I mean? Like, what's your approach? And maybe both approaches are good or bad. I don't know.
My approach is, when I was originally doing that, when it first started, I was just doing album dissections, and there were albums that I loved. So I knew going into it that I was fans of all these people. But as I'm doing this more one-on-one interviews, my goal is to find out what is to like about them. So I don't go in trying to get anybody on anything, and I don't go in trying to give what the fans want. What I've learned is, if you want to know how a punk ticks, you don't really ask them all questions about what it is to be punk. you just start talking about their life, that the way they grew up, what their philosophical views are, this, you know, the psychology works. So I don't really think about fanzine approach, and I don't really think about whether I like them or not. If that makes sense.
How about this question? You know, in punk rock, we see more and more of an approach is if someone is bad, you shouldn't post about them. Or if someone is bad, you know, you shouldn't interview them. Some of my favorite interviews are Tom Snyder with Charles Manson. You know, Charles Manson is a bad dude, but an interview with Charles Manson is very interesting, and maybe we can learn about what makes someone so bad. Do you think the counter argument is you shouldn't give bad people a platform because that spreads bad information? And a great example of that counterattack was the Trump era when all these bad, you know, giving Trump a platform really did spread a ton of misinformation. So yeah. What's your perspective on interviewing, quote, bad people?
Well, my perspective right now is I'm not big enough for those effects to make a big difference. I haven't really had a case where someone's done something horrible yet that I've interviewed. So I guess I'd have to wait to get to it. But I am a believer, like in philosophy, that you should study, you know, Heidegger, who was a Nazi sympathizer. I don't think you should attach that closely, the art and the person itself. But I would worry, you know, if I was bigger, it would be a bigger problem. And I probably worry a lot about making the wrong impression or giving support to someone that I don't believe in. But I haven't had to face that yet, really.
Charles Manson, Marilyn Manson's got a lot of problems right now. If Charles Manson said, I want to come on your podcast, what would you do?
If Charles Manson?
No, Marilyn Manson, not Charles is dead. Marilyn Manson. Marilyn Manson's got problems right now. And so if he wants to come on your podcast, would you have him on? Or would you say, you know, Marilyn, you've done too much bad stuff. I can't have you on.
No, I don't think I would do that. I would probably interview him. I don't know what the bad stuff is, and I don't care right now. But if I had to study them and they were on the show, I would, and it was an obvious thing we had to talk about, I'd talk about it.
Mm. Well said.
But I'm saying that I listen to this guy, David Pakman, who is a journalist, news commentary guy, and he talks a lot about that. Like, he tries to stay away from interviewing people that'll give too much publicity to them, but he also doesn't want to avoid it, and he wants to ask them real questions. So I think it's almost a case by case basis.
Honestly, that guy talks a big game, but you know, whenever like the ghosts chase him, he runs away. You know what I mean? So you know, yeah. Really annoying. So.
So I'm sorry. I'm sorry for my wishy-washy answer, but it's a really difficult topic.
John, second last question.
And I did get your Pac-Man joke, but
thank you. Second last question, John. what's coming up for the podcast? I know we're on episode 97, I think, right now. Is it going to be Big Splash 100, or is it just going to keep trucking along and doing what we do?
Well, my 100 lines up with my 10-year anniversary or 10-year anniversary year, so it's not technically my anniversary, but so I'm trying to line something up. No, I announced it on Facebook in a couple places. I don't know what I'm settling with. I'm looking for someone like a Tom DeLonge or a Mike Dirnt I've been trying to get for a while. Otherwise, I'm just going to keep chugging along. I just did a Justin Sane interview that I'm pretty proud of. So that's all it's about. It's about balancing people that'll get me other people and interviewing people that I want to have publicity.
Actually, I lied. I have one more last question than the last question.
Yeah.
You know, you talk, and you, if you don't want to answer, that's fine. You can, you know, so you take a. You said, oh, I, you know, Tom DeLonge. You know, I'd love to have him on. More and more with the, like a tribute album to Blink 182 just came out, and it's blowing my mind that bands like Blink 182 or whoever are the heralded bands, whereas, you know, back in my day, it'd be the Clash or Iggy Pop or the Sex. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it concerns me that bands that I consider to not be as crazy, not be as intense, not be as fierce, not be as groundbreaking are heralded as the new canon. Whereas, well, why not? Let's just have Iggy on or somebody it bothers me that radio rock is now being canonized in the punk realm. That bothers me, John. You might disagree.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree, but I'm not at the level where I can get someone like someone from Clash or something. I mean, I don't have a producer. It's me and word of mouth. But the reason I didn't even know how to say his name right, DeLonge, I guess. Well, I'm not a fan of Blink 182. I actually have criticized them quite a bit, and I talk about it on the podcast, and I wouldn't avoid that stuff talking to them. I think they were proselytizing to a very young audience and influenced people to be homophobic in a way that I thought was very hurtful. But I wouldn't have him on without discussing that. So
John coming out with the sharp answers. John, last question, then we're going to play some of your songs from your newest band. My last question is, I got to pull it up. My bad. I am doing really horribly right here. Anyways. Okay. So anyways, I got Ringo Starr's live in 2004 album. And Ringo always brings on like Colin Hay of Men at Work, or will bring on Ian Hunter of Motley Hoople. And he brought on the lead singer of Supertramp. And I'm not even a huge Supertramp fan, but I could not believe how good the singer from Supertramp, he sounded like in 2004, he sounded like the albums from the 70s. It sounded like it was a studio recording, and it's the singer from Supertramp live. How did the singer from Supertramp sound so good, John? How do you do that? I couldn't believe how good he sounded.
It depends on what type of voice you have to say. Like, some people that had higher voices when they were younger can't hit those stuff. So maybe he hit a sweet spot that maintains throughout the years. Like, I wouldn't expect Ronnie James Dio, if he were still alive, to be able to sing like he did. But someone like Leonard Cohen could definitely sing the way he does his whole life. It really depends on the range that you choose, I would imagine.
Well, fair enough. Let's play a song by John's newest group, the Mitochondriacs. Let's play, actually, it's two tracks. It's a couplet from their new EP, it's an EP. The EP is called Autonomous Mitochondrial Release. It is out via Mutant Pop Records, the excellent Mutant Pop label. And we are going to play Happily and then Disappointed, and then we will be back and hit the news. Talk about the news. This is actually shocking news, people. Shocking news in the world. Legs McNeil has left the website Please Kill Me. Of course, as you probably know, Legs McNeil wrote, I would say, the greatest music book of all time, the greatest second greatest oral history of all time, Please Kill Me, the uncensored oral history of punk. And it's got interviews with Iggy, Television, Richard Hell, the Sex Pistols, the Stooges, New York. It's got interviews with everybody. He co-wrote it with Gillian McCain, and there's always been this big thing is, well, who contributed exactly what? I think people often defer and kind of think Legs McNeil wrote the whole thing or most of it, and Jillian edited it. But I don't know that that's true. His name comes first, but who knows? At any rate, for many years now, maybe 10 years, he, along with Jillian and a whole bunch of other writers, have done the Please Kill Me website, which is similar to Punk News in that it covers punk, but it kind of looks more back at the history of punk, particularly CBGB's era, but they cover some new stuff too. And then astoundingly, just recently, Legs McNeil posted out of the blue, "I'm no longer associated with the PleaseKillMe.com website." And that's all he said. And then later on, he said he's going to start another website called Legsville, which is shocking and weird because Jillian is still associated. His name is still on the website. And so did he and Jillian have a big fight? I don't know. Is there bad blood? And it's weird that he's leaving something that is so closely associated with him. Like, he's the Please Kill Me guy, and he's not part of the website. It's almost like, if Joe Strummer leaves the Clash, is it still the Clash, I guess. Hallie Bullitt, were you shocked? Are you surprised, or after years of collaboration, most partnerships break down? What's your perspective?
No, it's so true, right? It always bums me out when I see stuff like this go on. I'm like, wow. I'm like, something. I mean, I don't really know what happened, but like something happened that's a big enough deal that the guy that wrote Please Kill Me is now no longer associated with the website that is. It seems like something that's a bummer happened, and you guys know it does. It like pains me to see long time relationships and collaborations breaking down, only because I know how hard it is to keep those relationships healthy and happy for so many years. And so you just feel like when you hear of the guys from The Cure arguing or whoever it is, you're like, oh, you're like, no, like, here we go again. It's like more artists like not able to get along with one another. But I don't know. It is strange. And I'll be interested to see, is it going to give the website just sort of less validity if he's not involved? Are people still going to be interested? I don't know. I'm wondering if he'll say more about it at some point, you know, because I feel like people are wanting an explanation, but I don't know whether he's going to give that to us or not. I don't know.
And more considering how Legs McNeil often, he's kind of a weirder guy. He says a lot of stuff. Do you think we'll get the big explanation, or is this just going to be a slow fade away, or is Please Kill Me going to keep trucking along and people don't even necessarily associate with Legs McNeil? What do you think?
I think it's going to be a whole thing on his website. Like, I think, you know, here's the 5-part story of what happened with Please Kill Me, and here's why I'm no longer associated. But it's not going to be straightforward. Like, I think there's going to be something to it. I think the Please Kill Me site will go on. Like, I think it was yesterday, like, it updated. So, you know, people are still writing, people are still looking at it. So I don't think that's a problem, or that will really be affected. And like Legsville is so insular, you know, like it's just like himself. That's it. So it made me think, like, is this going to be more of an autobiographical thing? You know, because he has tons of he's done tons of stuff. Like, he has a lot he can talk about. So I do want to know what happened. like, if it was an amicable like split, like just, oh, I'm tired of being in a partnership and I just want to go off on my own, talk about myself for a little bit. Or if there was a huge fight. So,
John,
just have to wait and see.
There's a parallel between this and your own interview. You know, you did your interview with Polly Van Damme, and something that we talk about on the Punk News podcast at least a couple of times is back in the day, back in the 80s, back in the 90s. You know, if Mick Jones isn't there on the Clash tour, people don't know that coming in, and people don't even know why leave. Like, there's no like big news report that Mick Jones isn't going to be there, or even more so, like, you know, if it's Dead Kennedys, there's no big thing that D.H. Pellegrino, he's not going to be. No one knows, and almost no one even cares because social media isn't as prevalent. Now it seems like artists owe a lot more information to the public and the fandom than they used to. You know, if this was 1993 and Polly Van Damme wasn't there, people might not even know, or there might be like rumors, but there wouldn't be any solid info. But now people have to say, oh, I'm leaving the band because I got this going on, I got that going on. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? You know, and do you think artists feel pressured to divulge personal info that before the age of social media they wouldn't have to give out, you know?
Yeah. Well, I do think people, I don't know if they feel pressured, but I think people instinctively want to say something. And since it's more immediate, they can do that. But I don't completely agree with that. I think a big percentage of music listeners really still don't care. I just don't think they pay attention as much as, I mean, my experience with, like, I have the hardcore fans that won't listen to Weasel anymore because I'm there. But a lot of people don't even know I'm not in. You know, I would say 85% of the people don't know or don't care. So I tend to think that's still probably the case. I think all of us do, and you do, because we are music fans and into what's going on. But I've learned over the years that people just don't care as much as we do.
Yeah.
That's my thought on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, you're totally right. It is. And we're not going to drag this out too much, but like you read about like internet drama between bands or whatever, or within a band. And it's like, oh my God, like I can't believe. And then you go to this, like, how long was Jello out of the Dead Kennedys for? When people kept going to the show saying, oh, I saw Jello, and they thought they saw Jello when it was like people really don't care or don't know. It's true.
Here, I'll add one more thing, John, if I can. Yeah. I think they almost, to like highlight that, they almost probably have more of a genuine reaction to it. Because if they're listening to a band over years and they don't really pay attention to the band, they might all of a sudden feel, oh, I don't like this anymore. I don't know why, but I don't. And then that maybe they're reacting to someone being gone without them even realizing it, or they might just go on and listening and like it. And so that's genuine. It's like it's more genuinely saying whether they still like something or not. Whereas we're into it, we might get more offended by someone leaving. But if we were actually just to listen to it, we might make a more clear choice.
John, with the very clairvoyance, if you will, and more, one of your bands that you like, Pussy Gillette, have released a new video. The video is for Hard Living, and it's got kind of an 80s VHS vibe. And more, tell us about Pussy Gillette.
Yeah, so they are a garage punk band, and they're out of Austin, Texas, and they're really exciting. They're really cool. So, they have a very, like, raw energy and, like, kind of a throw, not really, like, I think because their album was recorded live to cassette, so it has that kind of, like, buzz to it, and that fits really well with their video. So they've released Hard Living, which is this one, and they released Banana earlier, and both of them were shot to VHS, so it has, like, more of the, like, the vintage-y vibe kind of thing, and it fits their sound really, really well. And so in the video, the band are playing at a bar and they do pool, and the crowd is really into it and all this kind of stuff. And at one point, the lead singer and a guy are like, I guess he lost a bet to her, so he's paying her, and she like pulls a knife on him and all this. And it's just like, it's just kind of fun and everything. It has kind of a biker vibe. And one thing that's kind of neat with that is on their album, they have a song called Jane Pettibon, which is named after a character in a biker themed horror movie called The Death Wheelers from 1973. So it's just like everything ties together. It's just, it's really, really cool. So yeah, like they're really energetic. They're really, really interesting. Like they're one of those bands where there's more to them than meets like the eye at the first sight or first listen. And also just another cool holdover from the Banana video. They have a dog in it and his name's Walter. So yeah, it's just kind of cool. And their album, their self-titled album, is on Hidden Gems 2021. So check that out on punknews.org. What did you guys think of Hard Living by Pussy Gillette?
I mean, I liked it. I was not as into this as I was into Banana. Like it lacked just like the sheer weirdness that like drew me into Banana. There was no people in banana costumes standing by a barbecue. There was no like someone eating banana with fork and knife while like wearing a purple bikini. Even the song itself was just sort of like had a more sort of a generic kind of scuzz rock, like bar rock sort of feel to it. And the video was just like a lot of people wearing leather doing shots and like feeding the dog Walter. Walter gets a shot, right? So like he doesn't, Walter do a shot in the in the video. So it's like, I kind of longed for just the, even just the way Bananas, like it's got just that sludgy, slower tempo. There was something so appealing to me about that, but I still, like, I do still really like this band. This wasn't necessarily like their, like, I don't know. This wasn't the song of theirs I was going to connect the most with, but I still like this band. I'm still like very interested to see what else they're going to do. What did you guys think? The Johns.
Oh, John.
You want me to go? Yeah.
I come from a place where I didn't know any other material by them. So I was reacting more to that. I really appreciated the 70s raunchiness of it. So I'm not surprised that it's based on like a 70s motorcycle movie. So I really liked that. But to be honest with you, I wanted to hear more of it, not because I really liked it, because I wanted to compare it to other things, because I didn't really like her as much. I didn't think her voice was as good as someone like a Susie Moon or Miski D from City Mouse. It just didn't have that power that 70s I expected from it. So, but I don't want to blame the band. I kind of wanted to dig in more and see if that was just that one video or not. But it just seems like she couldn't hit the notes quite right, but she looked the part. She looked great.
I agree. The vocals are a little pitchy, right? In a way.
Yeah,
like exactly. I try not to be too exacting about that. I don't want everything auto-tuned, but like I do want I do want you to hit the note. You know?
Yeah. Or at least squeal or screech or you know, it just seemed a little bit too protected in the in the hitting those notes.
Yeah.
Well, I'm on Team Ed Moore and I think this band is pretty cool. I honestly, you know, in punk rock, you're not supposed to care about, you know, image or whatever. But honestly, it makes a difference. Did you have three people on stage or four people on stage? How do they act on stage? It makes a big difference in the art itself. And I think to ignore that is doing a disservice to the art. What I'm saying here is I dig how I can't tell if this band is retro or futuro or both at the same time. I dig how you could – I mean – this singer is a badass, and I like off the bat. I like how it does sound like an amphetamine reptile type track, and I also really like how it's only a minute and 45 seconds, I think, the time you cut out all the stuff, which I think that's perfect. So I think this band, I mean, is it the greatest band I've ever heard? No, but I think they've got real promise, and I'm digging them, and I'm very excited to hear what they do next. Here's someone that I'm really excited about right now, Marissa Paternoster. Her first solo album is out, even though it's not truly a solo album. She's got a video for Black Hole. The album is called Peace Meter. I just thought this album was fantastic. I actually did a review for it at Punk News. I think the three songs are great. If you're not familiar with Marissa's new solo stuff, it's kind of like, well, actually, it's not like Screaming Females at all. I compared it a lot to Stevie Nicks, but actually, I kind of think it's more like Eurythmics in that it's kind of Marissa, kind of some 80s-ish synth backing that's kind of rock. You know, propulsive. She sings a lot and a little bit of guitar here and there. I would say the song Black Hole actually sounds very gothy or very This Mortal Coil-ish, you know, 4AD. And I just think Marissa is fantastic at singing. I was really surprised at how the whole release is kind of a depressing release, and I still like it. It's dark. It almost sounds like a goth record at points. And I like the video. I like how the video is a relatively simple video, but with the if you watch the camera work, it's a fisheye lens, so like the entire world bends around her. And at one point, it looks like she's in a room, and there's no outlet to the room. It's like the entire universe is her room. I think this record is a stellar record. I think the video is a really good video, and I think Paternoster is fantastic. And I am down with this. Halle Bullet, Paternoster. Thumbs up or thumbs down? Where are you standing?
You know how much I loved that last, like, really new wavy song we talked about. So I had to get over my initial disappointment that it wasn't more in that direction, because that really, really spoke to me. But I liked the song, and I still had it stuck in my head like a good, 10 minutes after I had listened to it. So that's something. I thought the video was interesting. I liked that, like you said, a lot of it's with fisheye. We see her sort of in her apartment. The thing that I really was noticing that I liked a lot was that the song is called Black Hole. It's about being in a really dark headspace. And yet you look at the settings of this video, it's really quite cheerful. It's pretty cheerful settings. She's in like, there's a lot of like bright yellows and like big giant window behind her with plants. And yet like the fisheye lens is making it look so just disorienting and, I felt like there was such a neat statement being made there about how it just doesn't matter if you're in like a calm or a cute or a pretty setting, if your perspective is warped. And I felt like that was really capturing something that she's talking about in the song, just about her, just being sort of trapped in this really dark mental space. So I just think she's cool. I like to see what she does. I always find it interesting. And if she wants to release more really like new wavy, catchy shit like that last single, then that would make me even happier. John Jughead, what did you think of this?
This is exciting because I'm coming to a lot of people that I didn't know anything about. And I imagine I hear she was in, or is in a band called the Screaming Females. Is that correct? Is that
right?
Yeah. I was really taken by her voice, which is slightly odd, like a lisp or something. That's very, that I really enjoyed. It really intrigued me. She sold the whole video for me. I didn't care for the video as an art form. I think she's the one that makes it fascinating to watch. And maybe by the topic being so, like you said, so it's about darkness and black, that maybe just showing her mundane day was the way to go, because that's that to me, that has levels and complexity more than making it dramatic. So I really came off, that was out of all the stuff we were listening to and watching, that was the one that I came out most affected by, was that song.
And more, what'd you think of the third and final Mercy Paternoster solo single?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. The thing that really like gets me is each of the singles, they all have such a different tone and a different feel to them, so you don't know what to expect like going in, because like Hallie, yeah, I wasn't sure if it was going to be more like the last one or if it was going to be more like kind of understated like the first one, or what was going to happen. And this was really, really cool. Her voice is just nuts. Like, that's just amazing. Like, there's so much like depth and emotion and everything there, and it's just like, it's so good. definitely like the goth influence and everything, heard that, and it's supremely catchy. Like, I wasn't expecting it to get stuck in my head, and then I was like humming it during the day and, you know, all this. It's like I have to listen to it again because it's there. So I liked the video. I found some of the fisheye parts like kind of hard to watch just because they're so disorienting, and I think that's the point, right? Like, she's singing about like a space that's really uncomfortable and really horrible to be in, so let's, you know, put you right there almost. So I thought the video matched the song really, really well. I haven't had a chance to listen to the full album yet, but I'm looking forward to it because I'm going to do that on the weekend.
Do you think three singles that sound totally different from each other, or not totally, but significantly different from each other, good strategy or bad strategy? What do you think?
Great strategy.
There you go. Final word from Moore. Okay, let's talk about something that I've got definite opinions about. And I've been having the same opinion for the past 10 years. Deep Ignorant of Crass has released another live album, and it is called Live in Knots 2021. And it is a recording of the Steve Ignorant of Crass band playing in September 2021 at the Old Cold Store in Nottingham. And I will say, I love in England and especially in Wales, like in America, it'll be like, I live at 134 Walnut Street in, you know, in Westchester, Pennsylvania, or something, you know what I mean? But in England, it'll be like, I live at the old yellow church, you know, South Riverbend. You know, it's like their addresses are literally just like places. Anyways, this record, this live album, is Steve and his band doing all Crass tunes, which Steve started doing about 10 years ago. And actually, he's released two other live albums that are somewhat similar in approach. One is the first time he did Crash Music Live, which was called, I think they called it the final sitting or something. And then the second one was just kind of like a, oh no, the second one was all of, I think, no, the first one was all of the first album live. And I think the second one was just like 30 Crash tracks. And of course, Steve, when this first happened, got a lot of heat because people were like, oh, well, you should be selling Crash, and, you know, Crash is anti-commercial, so you shouldn't be playing this live. Crash is broke up. You're not Crash, and you shouldn't be selling tickets, and how dare you charge $20 for tickets? You know, it's Crash. It's, you know. And my opinion is you're a bunch of knuckleheads. Crash rules. Steve rules. I feel that perennially Steve has not gotten enough credit for his contributions to Crass. People often, you know, look at Penny Rimbaud and G. Voucher and Eve Libertine, which they should, and all those people are amazing artists and very cool people. That being said, Crass without Steve is not Crass. Penny Rimbaud, Eve, G, they're all very – they come from an arts background. Penny Rimbaud comes from a bohemian background. Steve Ignorant is the working class guy, and Steve Ignorant likes to say Penny Rimbaud's solo music is like throwing furniture down a stairway, and it kind of is. And I love Penny, and I love that Penny has whacked out stuff, but you need Steve to come in and just bring a pat. I mean, that Steve Ignorant takes high concepts and makes it easily digestible to anybody, and that's why he's incredibly important to the band. And that actually, and I actually stole that exact phrase from Penny Rimbaud, so you know that's from the horse's mouth itself. So A, Steve doesn't get enough credit. B, I don't think any musician has ever written a song with the purpose of it not being played ever. And so Steve's not saying I'm Crass. And in fact, one music festival billed it as Crass, and Steve immediately had them change it to Steve Ignorant Plays Crass. And he's saying, I'm Steve Ignorant. I wrote a lot of these songs. I performed most of them. This message is important. And I'll point out also that you know, a lot of people have, you know, high and mighty opinions, but Steve, and Penny especially, though, Steve too, walks the walk, you know. All of Steve's shirts, all of his CDs, all of his records are made in England. You know, he volunteered for what they call, like, I forget, basically when people get lost at sea, he goes out, not anymore, but he did. He would go out with a boat and, like, rescue people, which is pretty rad, you know what I mean? So it's not like he's doing, like, IT for, like, Amazon or something. He's, like, in a boat rescuing people. You know, he used to be a puppeteer. So Steve really has lived by, more or less, as well as anybody could, the values that Crash established back in the 70s and early 80s. And actually, as Steve said in an excellent interview with Bandcamp, I can't remember who interviewed them, but it was like a really good interview with Bandcamp, where Crass walked through the entire history. Steve talked about how after Crass, he kind of looked around and realized, I'm screwed. I spent my entire 20s in a band. I have no skills, and now I'm broke as hell, and I have no marketable skills. So if this is the way that Steve Ignorant can get money, and because he devoted so much of his 20s to amazing art, I'm all for it. But not only that, it's not only a one-sided transaction. I saw Steve Ignorant live once in about 2013. They did about 40 Crass songs, and it was incredible. It was incredible. I loved it. And so it's not like, you know, oh, well, poor Steve, you know, let Steve make – it's like, you know, please, Steve, come and do it because it is awesome to see, and I'm happy to see you. Steve Ignorant rules. John, Jughead. Steve Ignorant doing Crass, a betrayal of the core message of Crass, or a further spread of the message, and it proved that the message stands strong.
Well, I'm sorry to throw it back at you guys, but I'd rather actually hear other opinions because I haven't listened to Crass since I had an EP from 1987. So I don't know. I don't feel qualified to listen to it, but I am gaining some thoughts with my own experience. So I wouldn't mind other people talking first before to me, if that's okay.
Howie Bullitt, what's your stance?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have, you know, I don't like have like Jughead. I don't have like a strong connection to Crass. I do think there is something to me where if it was just him touring and playing the songs, I wouldn't question it at all. I think people should play the songs that they wrote and that they performed. And if people want it, if there's still an audience for it, like, do it. There is something about releasing it as an album when the band is broken up and the other people aren't involved. Mm. There's something to me where that might cross a line for me. But again, John, like, I just feel like you know more about the history of the band. But I'm just going to say, as just like a blanket thing, as a songwriter and people that a person that's played in bands, there's something about releasing those songs as an album without your other band members that seems a little strange to me. I don't know. Em, what do you think?
Yeah, that was my stance too. Like, I think it's great that he's performing the songs, because like the songs are so vital and they mean so much to so many people. They can be interpreted so many ways to an extent. And they're really, really relevant. And just as somebody, you know, who wasn't alive during the time that Crass was touring and stuff, like, to see this would be absolutely nuts, because like, Crass were one of the bands that helped or kind of got me thinking about things and shaped some like ideological ideas and beliefs and everything that I hold. And he was so instrumental in the song, so that would be, I don't have a problem with him performing them, and again, that would be great. But the CD seems kind of odd, because it's only, I think, 300 copies. Like, it's a limited thing. So if it was like you could get it digitally too, or if it was more widely available, I think that would fit better. And just one thing too, because when I was doing this, I was going through and I was looking at different things, and a quote that Steve Ignorant had in John, your interview with him for Punk News in 2017.
Oh, did I interview Steve before? Oh, wow.
Was, I realized that Crass is everyone's music, and it almost feels like it's not mine anymore, and that's not a bad thing. So I think that kind of defines him performing it. And it's almost in a way like he's giving the music back to the people, or not really giving it back, but saying like, hey, this never left. This is yours. Here it is. And, you know, like giving people what they want, and also kind of giving people what they need. And this could be a push that a lot of people need. So always trust in the anarcho-punks.
And actually, I'm going to add in something. First of all, I bet my question that was the answer. I bet my question to Steve was, do these songs mean the same thing to you now that they did 40 years ago? I bet anyways, the second thing is I know Steve was trying to do a US tour before COVID, and that got canceled by COVID. And I have no inside info at all. I'm almost definitely going to go to Punk Rock Bowling next year. It would be so cool if they had Steve Ignorant at Punk Rock Bowling, because I love Punk Rock Bowling. Punk Rock Bowling is real cool, but most of the bands at Punk Rock Bowling are not super political bands. Some of them are, but a lot of them are just, you know, let's have some fun, you know, where Steve has a real, real message, and it would be so cool to see Steve up there on the big stage, you know. And I like, you know, like Mean Jeans is an awesome band. They don't have a super message or anything, but that's not saying anything bad about them. But it would be awesome to have the contrast between even the Crass and NOFX, or Steve Ignorant and NOFX, or Steve Ignorant and I don't know, any other band that is nice and poppy that people like. John, I don't know if you got any comment on that, or you can take a pass as well.
Yeah, no, I'll try to sum up my thoughts. I'm somewhere between Haley and Em in this one. I think it is odd to record them and sell them. I think being in a band like Crass, that is a political band that's been around for so long, you're under a microscope all the time. So I don't blame any of them for trying to do what they can to survive. So it's really hard. But you said there was a limited version of it. That's what it is. That almost makes me think that he isn't trying to conquer the world with it. It almost sounds like he's just trying to get by, like something to sell on tour, something to get him through. So I'm caught between the two. Like I don't think someone should purposely try to redo music and sell it as that music. But I also think people need to survive, especially people that were so political that the machine doesn't feed them as well as it does like people that sell out.
Yeah.
Two last quick stories, and we talked about the existence of the machine here. The Linda Lindas have released a new song. The new song is called Nino, and I think it's like their third single they've released since their EP. When the Linda Lindas released their first song, which was called like Racist Boy or something like that, it was a huge viral thing and exploded all over the internet. Racist Sexist Boy was the song. It exploded all over the internet, and honestly, it was a pretty good song. Then they released their second song, which was Oh, And that was actually kind of a cool kind of, you know, new wavy power pop type thing that people dug. They released a new single. It's a standalone single. It's called Nino or Nino. I guess Nino, not Nino. And I thought it was pretty good. But honestly, it did not set the internet on fire like the other stuff. It kind of just came out and kind of sat there. The question, the greater question here, and I'm going to throw it to Hallie first, but I'm going to keep talking to Hallie to, you know, time to think it over, is we talked about how this band, one of the young ladies, her dad is in the music biz, and he's kind of a big wig music biz guy. And so the question is, well, is it fair to throw a bunch of 12 to 14 year olds into, you know, the public eye, you know, or maybe because they have such kind of an interesting message and a good message, maybe it's a good thing for them to do that. But also, as Hallie previously pointed out, is maybe since one of the dads is a music guy, he's more able to prepare them for the public eye. Whereas if your dad is just, you know, a car salesman or something, or you know, pack, you know, box packer, you know, he might not be able to prepare you for the public eye and the oncoming rush. The second question is here, and I hope I'm wrong, is there was so much popularity with those first two singles, especially the first one. Will these young ladies maybe have a problem with the fact that the third one didn't explode all over the internet, and that people, the public as general, didn't seem to have as much care about it as much? You know, a lot of child stars, you know, they're super famous when they're 8 to 12, and then after they're 12, they have a real problem because they're not famous anymore. Now, these young ladies aren't that, you know, they're not as famous as, like, the kid from Growing Pains or something, you know, so they hypothetically, they could go back to their regular life. Or am I just overanalyzing this and I'm, you know, dwelling way too much on something that's just a cool little single? Allie Bullitt, what's your stance?
Yeah, I think you might be overthinking it. I mean, they you know, they had two songs that were pretty huge. I mean, I think for a band, you know, it's awesome if you get more than that with a record, but two songs that people really love and connect to, and you know, that's pretty good, especially for 12 to 14 year old girls. I mean, it's interesting, like O seemed like a more complicated composition. This is, now we're back to something that I believe that a 12 to 14 year old like wrote this song, right? It's just a song about a cat. I mean, it's good, it's cute. I mean, I don't know if you're gonna have a huge hit with a song you wrote about a cat, you know. I can't think of any songs about pets that were like huge hits that just grabbed everybody. But it's like,
I can't, know. Michael Jackson's Ben, which people think is about a childhood best friend, is actually about his pet rat. And Quincy Jones said to Michael Jackson, why don't you try to write that a song that emotional about a person as opposed to a rat? And Michael Jackson could not.
That's amazing. But yeah, you know, I liked this. I thought it was cute. And, you know, it's clearly just we're now getting into the, we're just now, they came out strong with their best songs, and now we're getting to the other songs, you know. But I don't know. I think they're cool, and I like what they're doing, and I really hope people don't, I hope it's not like you're saying, John, where I hope people, it's not a like a flash in the pan thing. I hope people give them the chance to have some longevity to find their voice more as songwriters. I think there's just so much potential there. So I hope the interest that people stick with them, you know?
And more, Linda Lynn is here to stay, or are we at the end of the party?
People need to like stick around. Like they need to see, cause this is, again, they're so young, like they're going to grow, their sound's going to grow. You know, like it's I think they have a lot going on that we haven't seen yet, and I think that just will come with time. I thought the song, like the song's fun, the video's fun, like it's all just like, you know, it's great that way, and it's nice to see something that's like that's fun, that's colorful, it's not like taking itself overly seriously. And I think all bands, or not all bands, but most bands, like have songs like that to balance out, or to kind of show another side, or again, just to have fun. Because if you're writing stuff that's very political or very like dealing with like hard issues, if you're performing those regularly, like that can take a toll on you. So it's nice to have something to kind of fall back on to bring some lightness to it. And on their Instagram, they have a picture of the cat, and it's like a little fluff, and his tongue sticks out, and it's just like the cutest thing. So yeah, I think stick with them, give them a chance, and songs about cats are great. Like, to name at least one other one that's just stellar. So yeah.
John, you enjoy songs about pets, and also you were a young man when you first started doing music. Can one be too young to first start music?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. But I don't like it being as if, and this isn't just referring to that band, but it now in this, I don't know, the last couple of years, it seems like a big, big thing that there's some of these young bands are around. But that's been, to me, that's been the case for a long, long time. So it's nothing new. I try to really just listen to it as whether I like this song or not, whether they're young or old. I don't mind young kids being in the scene. I think that's cool. I think it's amazing. My friend Jay Gavin has his kids' friends are all in a band, and they do really great covers. But I don't really have a horse in this race. I just I'm not fascinated by it. I won't listen to it if I have my headphones on in my room. You know, I almost want to say put in your time and then I'll see if I like it.
Well, here's a band that has put in lots of time, and they're waiting on that time. Green Day, they're releasing a record called BBC Sessions, which was recorded, I guess, throughout the 90s and into the 2000s. It's all their BBC Sessions put together. I've given my opinion on Green Day many, many times, so I'm not going to reiterate it. And more, I think this is probably the final single from the BBC Session. This is one of Green Day's more serious, reflective songs. Are you down? Are you excited? And is it good that, you know, the question with Green Day is people sometimes say they put out too much material, but maybe this is quality material and it should be put out rather than wither away. What's your stance?
I've really been enjoying like the live songs that have been coming out, because they've been releasing them every week since they announced the album, and it comes out, I think, this Friday. So, you know, like, it was something to look forward to, like, oh, every Friday there's going to be a new Green Day live song. It's going to be cool. It's going to be, you know, like a song I like, and, it, you know, so I don't think there's anything wrong with releasing a lot of content on one hand, because, again, you have a lot to look forward to. You have a lot to listen to. You have a lot to just kind of experience. But on the other hand, it is kind of like, well, what's the point of like buying the album, or what's the point of really interacting with it more because you've heard so much of it? But with this, I think this is really quality, because all the live stuff they've released so far has been really good. I like this song. It's okay. It's not my favorite Green Day song, but I think the live version of it is very good. And I, even though what I just said, like, I don't want all the releases to ruin the album, I'm still going to check out the album, because they have been quality. They have been good. And that's when you know you're doing it right. So, Hallie, what did you think?
I liked it. I guess, because the thing is, for someone like me that just sort of stopped paying attention to Green Day at a certain point, I was like, oh, this song is good. It meant absolutely nothing to me when it came out in 2000. I just didn't care about Green Day. So I don't know. If anything, I feel like this release will just sort of make me maybe sort of re-listen to some of the stuff that came out over the years that I just didn't bother to pay attention to. But it's, I don't know. Is it that different from the original though, Em? It's not that different, is it?
Not really. Like, I think it's a bit more
raw, yeah.
Yeah, like there's more energy behind it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah, I mean, it made me listen to the song closer than I had when it was just like a semi like radio hit. And so, and in that way, yeah, I thought there was value to it, and I liked. So I guess the only ones that I've listened to off this so far are 2000 Light Years Away and this one, and I like them both, so yeah, I will not being the biggest Green Day fan, I do think I will actually give this a listen. And that's my thoughts.
I guess, John, we'll throw the last question to you. Do you have any opinion on this? And also, what are some bands people should check out today? What are some of the cracking new bands people should check out? Or some classic underappreciated bands, like Supertramp, perhaps?
Well, you know, Alex, I'm about to name an old classic band, because that's what I think about whenever I think of Green Day. But I guess I have a few thoughts. Like, I mean, they were friends of mine, so I go way, way back with them. But I was never really a big fan of them. I saw the crowd gather around them, and I saw it happen in front of my eyes. But I always thought they were like a second-rate REO Speedwagon. Like, I love REO Speedwagon, and I always thought Billy Joe sounded like that band. So it never was punk to me. And I saw it. I knew it was going to be big. But I'll say, as having become friends with Jason White, who is their second guitarist, and he doesn't get band royalties from records, this may even be like a nod to him, to get him, you know, money and stuff, and because he's on the live recording. So they might be doing it because they're those type of guys. They really do think about their people. So it might be a chance to, you know, as they're winding up and getting older, and, you know, they've been in it for 30 years, something like that. Maybe they're giving him a little something. I'm not sure. I don't know enough about them. And bands to check out, if you would tell me that ahead of time, I would have known better. But a lot of Americans don't check out a lot of great old European bands that were like pop punk bands, like the Mangies or the Apers or what's her name? Eagles. I can't forget. What's it? You know that band?
The Eagles?
Yeah, so yeah, the Eagles. There's a lot of great bands out of not the Eagles, like in I forgot their name. Never mind that band. I can't remember their full name, but they were also in the Apers. I would just say check out like 90s and 2000s European punk rock that a lot of people missed out on.
Well, they have it. Well, listen, John, thanks for being on the show. Be sure to check out John's website, which is it's Jughead's Basement Podcast, I believe is the website, jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. It's really good. Definitely check out those interviews. John does a real good job on that. John, thanks for being on the show. What song should we send the people out with?
You're saying in any out of any band?
Anything, man. Supertramp, REO Speedwagon, you know, whatever you want.
Oh, geez. I would say, that's exciting. Let's go with something with Rob Halford, Judas Priest.
My man. Let's talk about Rob real quick.
Vengeance.
We role play, but first of all, Rob is the man. What is up with Bruce Dickinson dogging on Rob like the past year?
Is he?
What's up with that?
I used to love Iron Maiden, but I never liked Bruce Dickinson. I dropped out before Bruce was in the band.
So you're a Deano guy.
Yeah, I'm a full-on Paul Deano guy. That's what made him punk to me. And then they were, you know, I saw a documentary where they were trying to say they were glad they got rid of him because they made him more metal, you know, a better band. And I always thought they were more unique with him in the band. So
to go back to our Pussy
Collect conversation. I don't really respect anything Bruce says. I would be in Rob Halford's corner till the end.
Well, I agree 100%. Two things there is, A, to go back to the Pussy Gillette conversation, Dickinson is a way better singer than Deano, but Deano is a way better singer than Dickinson, if you know what I'm saying. You know what I mean? Like, he's like so much better, even though he's so much worse. Very true.
I mean, he was a messed up guy, though. I mean, I don't think that band could have gone any farther with him. He was just really messed up. So I don't diss the band for getting rid of him, but I don't think it was better.
Well, listen, we all agree. Rob's the man. This is Rob and the boys doing Screaming for Vengeance. John, thanks for being on the show.
No problem.